It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, due to the impeachment trial preempting River to River over the noon hour, the talk show that I host, some of the news conversations that would normally be on that talk show are finding a home here on Talk of Iowa. Today is one of those days. Later in the program, my conversation with presidential candidate Tom Steyer, recorded earlier today. Before that, a conversation recorded yesterday with Democratic presidential candidate Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Mayor Buttigieg, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
This is a recorded conversation, but we did get some solicit some questions from listeners. I'll be putting those in our conversation here in the next 20 minutes or so. Let me, as a matter of fact, start off with a topic that is on our Facebook page, a question from Ann. She writes, Iowa has been struggling to cope with flooding, heat waves, and polluted waters. She asks, what solutions are you proposing to slow climate change, help small farmers, and clean our waterways? And if I could jump in here before you do answer that. Also, we know that last week the Trump administration finalized a rule to strip away environmental protections for streams, wetlands, and groundwater, welcomed by many farmers who said that the Obama-era rules had shackled them with unnecessary burdens. What is your position on the Waters of the United States regulation and Ann's question?
Well, I believe it's very important to protect our waters and waterways, not just for a future generation, but knowing the environmental impacts we're seeing right now. Now, as a mayor who has had the experience of running regulated water utilities, I understand the challenges of keeping up with those regulations. That's why it's important that we also be funding and supporting farmers and others pioneering techniques and using new materials that help make it possible to keep up. But the answer is not to fall down on the importance of clean water. The answer is to make sure that we're supporting everybody who is impacted by these regulations and ensure that we've got resources to help research new materials, new techniques, and new opportunities. Look, the big picture here is that every part of the country is being impacted by environmental damage in general and climate change in particular. Sometimes they talk about it like it's mostly something happening on the coast, but as we know in the Midwest, whether it's in Iowa or in my own River City where we had historic floods, floods that should only happen once in a millennium, more than once during my tenure alone, we see that climate change is no longer theoretical. It's happening to us. It is exerting a terrible cost, and it's only going to get worse if we don't do something. Mm-hmm. So here's what we can do about it. First of all, personnel is policy. We need a president who believes in climate science, and it's time for a head of the Environmental Protection Agency who actually believes in protecting the environment. It's making sure that we're engaging our partners around the world to do this. It's why I will rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement right away, but also take further steps to make sure that the U.S. is the world leader in global climate diplomacy. By the way, with U.S. credibility hanging by a thread, this is a good time for our country to be seen leading on something that the entire world knows is critically important. But I think we also have to change the way that we approach the conversation on climate to invite everybody to be part of the solution. And this brings me back to folks from our farmers to industrial workers who I think have been made to feel like they're part of the problem, but really need to be at the forefront of helping fight climate change, whether it's soil management and cover crop techniques in our agriculture, or whether it's making sure that we enlist the skills of industrial workers to fill those 3 million net new jobs we're going to create in my climate plan. This has to be a national project, mm-hmm. a national mobilization, and then it's no longer just a partisan football.
Back quickly to my point, the change that I mentioned that the Trump administration is making to the Waters of the United States regulation. What do you, though, say to Midwest farmers? And I've spoken to some of them with this opinion. They don't want environmental rules reaching into the management of their little streams and ponds on their lands. Would you take action to change that rule back to a more Obama-era approach?
I do think we need to restore these environmental protections. Now, I'm very open to conversations about how to make sure that compliance is as user-friendly as possible and that we're not only using encouragement or enforcement, but also offering resources to help with that compliance. You know, often we're telling or pressuring farmers to make these changes, but if they don't pencil out, we're putting them in an impossible position. That's why We need to be ready to put dollars behind these ideas. Now, we have things like EQIP and a conservation stewardship program, but we could be funding them better and opening new avenues. After all, we found billions of dollars to take the edge off of the trade war that never should have happened in the first place. Surely we can find the resources to support farmers and clean water at the same time.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg with us for this portion of the program. If you've just joined us, about a week, less than a week away from the Iowa caucuses. Let's switch over to foreign policy, if we could, Mayor Buttigieg. You've talked about restoring America's credibility and ending endless war, but in an interview with the editorial board of the Washington Post, you don't really seem to side with the popular rhetoric of getting fully out of the Middle East. Afghanistan is where you served. You've talked about ongoing interest in that country, like making sure Afghan girls and women receive an education. Explain for us what the presence of U.S. troops in Afghanistan would look like in the future under your administration.
Well, we need to bring an end to this endless commitment of large-scale numbers of ground troops in Afghanistan. I thought I was one of the last troops turning out the lights when I left, and that was years ago. That doesn't mean we have to completely disappear or stop playing any role. First and foremost, of course, we have to make sure that the American people are safe. And then through other tools that are available to us, diplomatic, economic, and international engagement, can work to make sure we're supporting other goals like retaining the progress and the advancement of women and supporting stability in the country. But if you want to get a sense of what it looks like in the short to medium term, you should actually look at what we had going on in Syria before the president pulled the rug out from under it. We had a tiny number of highly specialized special operations troops and intelligence personnel. They weren't there to try to change everything about Syria. They were there to make sure that threats to American lives and interests were managed. And that tiny number of people played a huge role in keeping things stable. That's the approach that we're going to need to take in the short to medium term as we wind down our commitment of thousands and thousands of ground troops in a place like Afghanistan.
Let's pivot over to another part of the Middle East, Iran. The U.S. has, under the current administration, withdrawn from the Iran nuclear deal. In November of last year, Iran said they would like to increase their enrichment of uranium up to 5%. That would surpass the 3.67% allotment there. Going back to this Washington Post interview that you I mentioned before, you said we can't simply resurrect and rejoin the Iran nuclear deal in its prior form. So what opportunities do you see with Iran slowing or stopping their movement to develop nuclear weapons?
Well, it remains so important to international stability and to us as a country that Iran does not develop nuclear weapons. Now, when the president left the nuclear deal, it set off a chain reaction that has led to everything from destabilization in our engagement with Iraq to more challenges in dealing with ISIS to, of course, this situation now where Iran, as you might expect, is moving closer to that nuclear scenario we were all trying to avoid. And now the reality is the next president will inherit a situation that is simply different than it was before because of President Trump's actions. That doesn't mean we give up. What it means is that we doubled down on our international engagement. We work with our partners. Remember, the Iran nuclear deal was not just a deal between the United States and Iran. It was a whole set of countries that all shared an interest in stability working to prevent this nuclearization from accelerating in Iran. We need to engage them and continue to use tools like economic pressure to guide the situation toward something that is more stable than where we are now. It won't be easy, but we can't give up on diplomacy and using the tools in our toolkit to prevent a scenario that could lead to further violent conflict in what is already one of the most volatile regions in the world.
Mayor Buttigieg, we have about 3 minutes before we have to take a break. I think we can get this one in that three-minute time frame. A couple of our listeners on our Facebook page asking about immigration, EJ and Tiffany. EJ mentions that Tuesday is the anniversary of this administration's Remain in Mexico policy. EJ says, I'm troubled by how the administration has treated migrant children and families, particularly its attacks on asylum. He asks, would you commit on day one to repeal this administration's so-called migrant protection protocols and discuss how you would fix a broken immigration and asylum system?
I would. These steps have not made America safer, and they have not made the border better. What's happening right now is really degrading America's moral authority and continuing to contribute to what has become a humanitarian crisis at the border. So, yes, we need to reverse many of these steps on day one, including the so-called MPP policy, the treatment of those who are seeking asylum, who, by the way, are within their legal rights when they make that request. But the reality is, in addition to the steps we need to take on day one, permanently ending family separation, moving away from there ever being such a thing as for-profit child detention centers, and a whole other series of steps we can take on the administration side immediately, we've also got to fix the immigration system once and for all. You know, there hasn't been a major immigration overhaul in terms of our laws since the 1980s. And we know what we have to do. We have to create a pathway to citizenship. We have to support and protect dreamers. We have to fix the lawful immigration system, like how my dad got here, and provide more opportunities for work-based visas, knowing that our economy needs it, which is why we have so many millions of undocumented immigrants living in our country right now. And yet there's been no way to bring the numbers and the quotas and the country caps into tune with reality. And by the way, no one has more to gain from this than folks in sometimes conservative areas that are hurting for population. It's one of the reasons I'm proposing what we call community renewal visas, that if the community chooses, can apply for an allotment of visas for folks who are willing to commit to living in areas that really need to grow their population. You see this in places like Storm Lake, where they have a parade of nations every year celebrating the contributions of some of the newest Americans who are living in the community, helping lift up the economy and build those towns in the area.
Okay, we have to
We need a totally different approach to show respect for immigration, not just how we treat migrants, but the benefit that it brings America.
We'll be back in just a moment with more on Talk of Iowa. Democratic presidential candidate Mayor Pete Buttigieg, please stay with us, Mayor. Back in just a moment. This is Iowa Public Radio. And we're back on this edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Due to the impeachment trial preempting River to River, some of my conversations normally for the noon hour are finding a home here on Talk of Iowa. This portion of the program, a conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Mayor Buttigieg, let's talk a little bit about your health care plan. It's divided into seven parts, and unlike the Medicare for All in your campaign, your campaign is Medicare for those who want it. Now, there's strong support from the left in the Democratic Party for a single government-run health insurance plan. What is your argument for opposing Medicare for All right now?
Well, the reason is simple, which is I don't think that we should order Americans to give up their plans if they don't want to. Look, I believe in the power of the public sector to provide a solution, which is why we would create a robust public health insurance plan. Now, if progressives, as progressives, if we are right that public-run plan is going to be the best one for everybody, then everyone will choose it without us having to command everybody to adopt it by a certain date. In other words, it puts a little bit of humility in the policy. And when we do it this way, if it is the right answer for everybody, it becomes a very natural glide path to get to a Medicare for All environment. And if, on the other hand, there are some Americans who would prefer to be on a different plan, we ought to be glad we didn't kick them off of it. And so here we have a way to solve the problem, make sure there is no such thing as an uninsured American, do it in a way that most Americans believe is the right approach, and do it in a way that we can clearly pay for as a country.
Mm-hmm. I understand, though, under your proposal, Americans who lack coverage, any coverage, would be automatically enrolled in the government plan. How will you get Americans to pay their unpaid premiums, for instance, in retroactive coverage, low-income families who might not be able to afford the bill?
Well, this is set up in a way that low-income families will not find it unaffordable. It'll be subsidized. But what we can't have is free riders. So just as we have under the Affordable Care Act, make sure that No one who could afford the plan but chooses not to could take advantage of the system. And this can be run through the tax code, again, as we have under the Affordable Care Act, and it's been successful. But just to be clear, this is designed to be affordable for everybody and to have subsidies that make sure that it is free for low-income folks who would not be able to get care otherwise. Mm-hmm. And this brings me to the broader point, which is this isn't just about making sure everybody gets coverage. And I'm glad you mentioned the other elements of our health care plan. There are so many things that we have to do that aren't getting as much attention because maybe they're not part of that same controversy over coverage. We got to lower prescription drug costs. We got to let Medicare negotiate. We got to do something about providers in rural areas that are losing their clinics and their hospitals. We got to have mental health and attack the racial inequities we see in health outcomes. There's so much to do in getting our health care system right. Making sure everybody's covered is necessary, but it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this related question. I really kind of two questions, a comment from Ross on our Facebook page. Ross writes, I'd ask him why he accepts money from dozens of billionaires and have him tell me exactly how that influenced his rapid backpedaling on Medicare for All.
So my position on healthcare has been the same from the beginning. And by the way, the insurance industry attacked my plan the moment we came out with it, I think because they don't want to have the competition. Now, I don't take any money from corporate PACs, but I also don't turn away individuals who want to contribute to the campaign that's going to defeat Donald Trump. We've gotten over 2 million individual contributions in the first year of this campaign. And obviously, as somebody who started with no national name recognition, somebody who's not a senator, and as the only person you'll see on the debate stage who is not a millionaire, we had to build this campaign from the ground up, and I'm proud of what we've been able to do. And we're engaging the help of everybody who wants to contribute to a campaign that will ultimately defeat Donald Trump. Because I can tell you on the other side, they're going to stop at nothing to stay in power. I think they've already put together more than $300 million. And I'm not going to go up against Donald Trump with an arm tied behind my back.
Mm-hmm. Back to talking more about money, taxes perhaps here too. There's a trillion dollar deficit in our country, and you've said this could be a financial time bomb that'll go off in your lifetime. If all of the plans that you describe are implemented, how will it remain budget neutral, not add to the deficit, and hopefully then have a surplus at some point?
Well, it's simple. I'm not afraid to insist that we raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans and start requiring corporations to pay their fair share. All of the things that I'm proposing are also paid for in my tax proposals. And so if you take everything I've offered in this campaign, all taken together, it will serve to reduce the deficit over time. And it's as simple as making sure that we gather the revenue that we need. Wealthy individuals should be paying more. We need to close these loopholes. We need to reform capital gains tax. And it's very clear that if a company like Amazon or Chevron can pay zero in federal income taxes, something is very broken in our system. If we're willing to take the steps to get that revenue, then we will be able to fund investments in everything from early childhood education to childcare to healthcare to infrastructure. And those investments in the long run pay for themselves, which is a lot more than you can say for these tax cuts for the wealthy that Trump has passed and that Republican administrations in the past have championed.
About 5 minutes left in our conversation with Mayor Pete Buttigieg, of course, Democratic presidential candidate. Let's go back to our Facebook question. This one from Joe. Joe writes, should someone in the wedding industry be fined $200,000 for following their conscience? I think I'm not sure about the figure there, but Joe seems to be referencing the Supreme Court ruling in 2018, the Masterpiece Cake ruling in favor of a Colorado baker who refused to make a custom cake for a same-sex couple because of, he said, his religious beliefs.
So I think it's wrong to discriminate, and I think our country has never regretted taking steps against discrimination. We have demonstrated as a country that we move in the direction of acceptance and tolerance. And if a business is selling a product, they should be willing to sell that product to any customer without discriminating against them because of who they are or because of the minority they belong to.
Let's talk a little bit about the politics of your campaign here, the Major criticisms of you include your relatively short resume as an ex-mayor of a 100,000-person city, also your weakness among African-American voters, according to some polls. How do you answer those concerns?
Well, when folks ask why I would run as somebody from a mid-sized city, I say that's very much the point. You know, there are communities like mine, the size of South Bend or Davenport, that have completely felt passed over by our politics, even though our communities are full of people who have the most to gain from the policies I'm talking about, raising wages, protecting workers, delivering paid family leave, and have the most to lose from allowing the Trump administration to continue. We need a voice, I believe, from the middle of the country and from these kinds of communities that my party, frustratingly, seems to have lost its ability to connect with, to our great detriment. So, yes, I'm from a smaller community. I'll also say that as a mayor, you are on the ground solving problems, getting things done in a way that's just different from Washington. Look, if you're looking for the most Washington experience, then, of course, you've got a clear choice. I'm not the candidate with the most years spent in Washington. What I will say is that,
We're running out of time. I just wanted to make sure you commented on the other part of that question. How do you plan to address your low polling status among black voters?
So my support among black voters is highest among those who know me best in South Bend and actually here in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest. We certainly have more ground to gain in the South, where many candidates, including African-American candidates, have struggled to get out of the single digits. I think that we're addressing a lot of voters who are rightly skeptical of voices with big plans and big ideas at a time when they have felt taken for granted and often had their votes kind of assumed by our party. So I recognize the hard work that we've got to do. But we're also talking about voters who are extremely pragmatic, want somebody above all who can win, who can defeat Donald Trump. And the best way to demonstrate that you can win is to go out and do it. And of course, the first chance to do that is right here on the ground in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left. Quickly, where do you stand on gun control? What's a profile of your policy there?
Well, we need background checks. Even most Republicans agree that we have to at least do that. We need red flag laws that allow us to disarm domestic abusers and can create an intervention when family members know that a loved one could be a danger to themselves and others. And I also believe that any kind of weaponry remotely resembling the kinds of weapons of war that I trained on in order to go to a place like Afghanistan have no business being sold in the United States of America for profit. And the thing is, these are common sense policies that most Americans believe we ought to have. The fact that something like background checks can have 90%+ support among the American people and still not get a majority in a place like the U.S. Senate shows you just how broken our politics has become. I think it's one more example of why we can't solve these problems with the same Washington mindset that has been recirculating and regurgitating arguments and approaches for decades. It's going to take a new approach.
Okay.
And that's what I have to offer relative to those with the most, perhaps, establishment time under their belt.
Very quickly, in less than 30 seconds, we ask all the candidates on this program, how do you stay mentally and physically fit for campaigning?
Well, great thing about Iowa is it's full of these river towns, which are great for taking long runs. So I try to get one in whenever I can and doing our best to eat healthy, although certainly the campaign lifestyle doesn't lend itself to the best nutrition.
Okay. Former Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Democratic presidential candidate. Mayor Buttigieg, thank you for joining us in this portion of the program.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.